Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
A Living History production.
I'm Peter Hart.
And I'm Gary Bain.
And together we're Pete and Gary's Military History
Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the podcast. My name's Peter Hart and I'm with lovely Gary Owen.
Gary Owen.
Gary Owen. Who's Gary Owen? Gary
Did he play
Bain.
For Wales?
Yeah, he must be from Wales. And we've had a bit of an incident already this morning, haven't we? Because Fred's opened up an early barrage.
Yes, and luckily in your direction.
Yes, his horse is pointing my way. This is a particularly bad start for this podcast, which I've been looking forward to, because a lot of people sort of think that the Royal Flying Corps, RNAS, their role finishes with the going over the top on the 9th of April. But it's only just the beginning. This series on the Arras Air War has got a long way to go yet. And that, and to sort of lead us in, what's this episode called?
Well, this one is called, surprisingly, Arras Air War, The Fight Goes On, which is pretty much what you just said.
On and on and on and on and on and on and on. So they've had great successes on the 9th, the Canadians on the left, the British on the right. So what would you say Tuesday the 10th was?
Well, I think you could probably say it was the day after the Lord Mayor's show.
Clearing up the ship.
That's one way of putting it.
and the Royal Flying Corps, of course, they're waiting for news of how it's going. They could see things. What do you think the first reports were like?
Well, they were naturally extremely favourable. The attack had been very successful, and the dramatic capture of Vimy Ridge naturally figured prominently in the initial reports.
Now, I think that the Royal Flying Corps, they've got really good reason to be proud of all they've achieved in this offensive and that achievement. And you're going to, let's hear from Captain Maurice Baring. He's Trenchard's main aide.
He's like right-hand man, isn't
right-hand he? Right-hand man at the headquarters of the Royal Flying Corps. And you're going to tell him what Baring says. Baring your soul.
We got news that 10,000 prisoners and 50 guns had been captured on the Vimy Ridge. I went to see the artillery squadrons at Bruay, which had done grand work during the fighting. The work of the army had been done in spite of the weather, in spite of our inferiority in machines, and in spite of the casualties.
Now, the thing is, what's to be done next? Because the attack's been a success, but Haig, who commanding overall of the BF, Horn commanding the First Army, and Allenby commanding the which army?
British.
Third Army. Good effort, though. I asked you because I wasn't certain.
Now, they all knew the importance of speed if they were to exploit the fleeting opportunities that had opened up before them. Yet, actually, this was easier ordered than done.
Yeah. You can say something's got to be done, but what about the problems on the ground? There's a principle here, isn't there? What is the principle? What's lying ahead?
Well, following up an initially successful offensive, it's still an intractable military problem. It's far easier for the Germans to move forward their reserve troops.
Why?
Well, because they've got the nearby railheads, whereas the British, the assault divisions, they've got to get across the shell-drenched wilderness, as you've described it, with their artillery, and that's, you know, really, really, really difficult.
And what makes things worse? What can make getting across a shell-drenched wilderness even worse?
Well, how about appalling weather, Pete? That's not going to help.
Well, got his mittens.
Well, he's certainly mit the Germans.
We got mittens as well, though.
With impeccable pro-German timing, the worst snows of the winter arrived to plague the British efforts. Moving any gun was back-breaking hard work, but it's almost physically impossible to get the heavy artillery forward in those conditions.
Now, there's another problem. What other problem do you have in First World War conditions? Where the communications problem. What do I mean by that?
Well, I think you're referring to what's described as the fog of war, aren't you? The orders to attack were both given and countermanded. The infantry waited for the cavalry. The cavalry were endlessly delayed and ultimately made only a token effort to explore the possibility of taking Monchy-le-Preux. And they were swiftly repelled.
They're not back, aren't they? Pretty quickly. Well, why is this? So essentially, the German line has already, within a day or so, been re-established. And you need a properly coordinated offensive to break through, not an ad hoc attack. Now, there's another problem for the Royal Flying Corps on the 10th of April. What would that be?
Well, we've mentioned the weather, but what we haven't said is that it was snowing. So you had snowy weather, and it meant that inevitably, very little flying was possible on the morning of the 10th of April. Yet, 2nd Lieutenant Charles Smart and Lieutenant Lytton, they went up in their BE-2E. In these conditions, it's practically suicide. But they didn't hesitate. And this is what 2nd Lieutenant Charles Smart of 16th Squadron has to say.
Early job out of bed at 4:40 a.m. In the air at 6 a.m. prompt. Doing another NF patrol. Not quite sure what NF stands for. Never mind. I'm sure knowledgeable people will. Very high wind blowing with an odd snowstorm thrown in. Nothing much doing at the lines, but I sent down one or two active batteries and pinpointed some fire. Just finished our time at the lines when we ran into our most awful snowstorm. Turned west at once, i.e. back towards the British lines, and flew for 10 minutes at a height of 600 feet. Absolutely blind. Could hardly see my hand before my face. I got the most horrible wind up, for there is a lot of high ground about here, and I was afraid of running into a hill. You mean things like Vimy Ridge, of course, yeah. As soon as I saw the earth, I made straight for it and landed safely. Was told by some soldiers that I just missed a chimney stack almost by inches, and I also saw a haystack just in the nick of time to avoid it. Oh, without any doubt, my luck was in, and I was never more pleased to reach the ground. Wow.
Wow. NF is naked flying.
Oh, well, they...
It was on a naked flying patrol. A
lot of that happening, wasn't it?
Oh, there was. Now, another pilot who was less fortunate as a snowstorm lashed his aircraft out of the sky.
It's always good that you're less fortunate, because you're going to be 2nd Lieutenant Albert Fanstone of 12 Squadron Royal Flying Corps, and you are less fortunate by nature.
I started out on a dawn patrol with my observer, Mousson. My orders being to watch and record troop movements in the enemy trenches. Once airborne, we were suddenly enveloped in the most appalling blizzard I have ever witnessed. We had just reached the lines when the storm, driven by a 60-mile-per-hour wind, reduced visibility to nil. Flying at a height of 1,200 feet, and knowing that the gale was steadily pounding my machine into enemy territory, I realised that our only chance was to get down, and I signalled to Mousson that we were going to land. We descended carefully, as I was, of course, flying blind. When the altimeter eventually recorded nil, and I could still not see the ground, I started to sweat a little. Suddenly, we were relieved to see the rubble of a ruined village, which I think was Adinfair. But there was obviously no chance of landing in that mess. I climbed for a second or two and tried again. This time, open ground appeared through the driving snow, but this turned out to be completely devastated by shell fire. Being unsure of our position now, I decided to chance it, and praying above all hope that we were facing into the wind, I went in. I was hoping to pancake, as a long run into the shell holes would almost certainly wreck us. As luck would have it, we came to rest between the many craters. Save for one slightly buckled wingtip, she was still in one piece, so we wrenched the machine gun from its mounting and dived into the nearest muddy shell hole. At best, we thought ourselves to be in no man's land, and for the next hour or so, we lay straining our ears for any sound or activity. But the only sound that reached us through that white wall of snow was that of the howling wind. Encouraged by the fact that we heard no indication of fire, we crawled from our shelter and moved slowly forward. Eventually, we reached the first trenches, and to our horror, we saw signs everywhere in the German language. Still finding no signs of life, we cautiously crept forward, and after a few moments of hesitancy, I saw to my delight, trampled in the mud of the trench, a packet of crumpled English cigarettes. Reassured, we moved forward and finally caught sight of a number of troops working on a rough track. It was with extreme relief that we found them to be a group of our lads from the Pioneer Corps, who informed us that this very position had been taken from the enemy only a few hours previously.
So quite fortunate in the end. They're unlucky to be forced down, but fortunate to land in Munich.
I'm just double-checking when this is April, and that snowstorm sounds horrific.
Well, we're actually recording this in April. What's the date today? It's about 19th, isn't it?
20th today.
Yeah, so it's only 10 days later, and it's lovely and sunny. Shirt-sleeve weather here.
Yeah.
Anyway, the weather picks up a bit later on the day, and the Army Cooperation Machines, that's the ones doing the artillery observation, the reconnaissance things, are busier than ever. There's also another vital thing, contact patrols are being regularly undertaken. Now, what are they? They're going over to locate where our troops have got to. Now, what do you think the crucial thing is for that to work?
Well, they're being forced to fly ever lower over the shattered landscape, often under heavy ground fire, yet the service they're providing was truly, truly life-saving to the hard-pressed troops.
Yeah, because they can bring down counter-fire or they can even intervene themselves. Now, I'm going to be Captain Bernard Rice of 8th Squadron Royal Flying Corps. We soon found the point at which our men were being held up and, diving down, loosed a bomb on the veritable hornet's nest of machine guns from 1,000 feet. Almost before the smoke had cleared, our men were in the place, so raking the back traverses with my machine guns, I pushed off in search of something else to strafe. This soon turned up in the shape of shrapnel bursts over our splendid infantry fellows below. So we hunted round and soon found the offending battery, my observer locating it and sending it down. He means sending down wireless messages to try and bring the fire down. Rice goes on to say, the gunners didn't open it at once, so I climbed to 4,000 feet and swished over and bombed them, which effectively stopped them laughing in church. That's a great expression. I'll stop you laughing in church, Gary. They were a good long way over, and I was watching intently to observe the damage I'd done when, rat, tat, tat, behind and over me, my left plane canvas was going rip, rip, and large gashes were appearing. So I kicked over the rudder and stood her on a wingtip, straightening her out on a new course. I looked back and saw a wicked-looking little scout spitting fire and coming down on us at a frightful speed. My observer fired like stink while he was manoeuvring to get behind us again. That means while the scout was manoeuvring to get them behind him. Just as he was about to make another dive on us, I turned again and we kept on firing. By that time, he was ready to dive again. He was up to 30 yards of us, so I went into a split-arse spiral. What a great expression. Gary, I'm doing a split-arse spiral, which did him altogether as he made off. So he made off, yeah. Flatly now, we sent another shower of bullets after him, eventually regaining our lines with 16 holes in our biplane. Wow, wow. What do you think of that, Gary?
I just think split-arse.
Yeah.
So that's what I'm going to take away from that quote. You do realise that.
You'll be saying that all the time now. So when the German guns opened on their targets, what's the main task of the Royal Flying Corps?
Well, the artillery observation aircraft, they're ideally situated to record their previously concealed locations and bring down devastating counter-battery fire. They also had a means of checking the effectiveness of their reconnaissance work. And this is what Captain Eric Routh, yeah, of 16th Squadron has to say. When we captured Vimy Ridge, a Bosch gunner who had just come up to the trenches to look for an observation post was also captured, and with him a map showing all their battery positions. Only two batteries in our area had escaped our notice. The sound ranging and photos had every other one accurately.
every other one. So that's just two. So isn't that fantastic? I mean, that shows the effectiveness of it. And with it, the sort of counter battery bombardments, they're just relentless. And do you think this impacts on the ability of the German artillery to do what they want? Of course it does. They've got other things on their mind. They're not laughing in church.
I was about to say yes. It does impact. But you answered for me. But the German scouts, they'd not all been overcome. And they took a steady toll of victims from the all but helpless observation aircraft. But we've said this on a number of occasions. It was a price that had to be paid. But that didn't make it any easier.
Yeah, because where are the British scouts? Of course, that must be in their mind. But the British scouts, they did what they could to protect the Corps aircraft. But their real role is to sweep the German scouts and army cooperation, their own army cooperation, from the skies. That's their main task.
Not their own, the enemy's. It's a bit of an own goal if you sweep your own from the sky.
Oh, oops. Oh, no.
On the 11th of April, the British renewed their offensive. Allenby, who's in command of the Third Army.
He is, Gary.
Was determined to keep the initiative and prevent stagnation setting in.
I've often found stagnation setting in.
Well, Fred
I wish it set in with Fred.
Now, in truth, they're already too late. The German reserves of infantry artillery were moving up to the threatened Arras sector, and it was now decided that Monchy-le-Preux was the key to any further great success.
I could see what they're thinking. They're thinking that if you could capture that, that would unhinge, if you like. You're a bit unhinged. The Hindenburg line that stretch away to the south. That's the new Hindenburg line, if you know what I mean. So what's going to happen on the 11th? Well, what time does the offensive start? What time would you start an offensive?
Well, I'd start about 12:30, you know, have nice lay-in. But they started at 0500 on the bleakest dark morning imaginable. Three divisions struggled through the snow in a desperate attempt to get into Monchy. Now, bursting forwards with the support of a couple of tanks and even a stray squadron of cavalry, they managed to penetrate the fortress village outskirts and desperate street fighting began.
One of the worst types of fighting, I think we've commented on this before, because it has to be house by house. It's not even house by house, it's cellar by cellar, because houses then often had a cellar, which of course is an underground fortress in many ways. But what about the German artillery? They're now further back, of course, and they're not. We haven't been able to move our artillery forward. So the German artillery, are they beginning to take effect?
Yeah, I mean, they filled the air with exploding high explosive and shrapnel shells, but the advance had not been uniform. To the north of Monchy-le-Preux, a strong concentration of Germans in undamaged defence works within the shell of the old Rue chemical work succeeded in hurling back the attacking infantry. Without a mantle of shells smashing down into them, the massed German machine guns had a field day, and they inflicted severe losses.
Again, this shows what happens if the artillery aren't able to perform their role. Artillery guided by the Royal Flank Corps, but they can't get them all forward in this bad weather. To the south, there's a similar fate afflicts the troops who were going behind an inadequate barrage to attack the village of Wancourt. You've probably been there, but I haven't. So this is what we said earlier, isn't it? The Germans have established a firm defensive line, and it could resist any ad hoc attempt. It needs like the first day, a proper focused attack.
Now, one late addition to the British plans.
No, don't tell me about this.
This was a subsidiary attack assigned to General Sir Hubert Gough's 5th Army, and it was intended to distract attention and hopefully threaten the flanks and rear of the German defenders facing the main assault at Arras.
Yeah, the 5th Army is to the south, isn't it, of the 3rd Army. They've only just got into position because that's where the Germans had retreated in March. And they'd only just got forward to take up their lines in front of the Hindenburg line. No time for proper preparation here for the attack. So how does it go?
Well, not only was there no time for preparation, the 5th Army was already stretched, and Gough was hard pressed to scrape together sufficient troops to form a reasonable attacking force.
So what does he do? How does he? What? You can't do right for doing wrong. We've said this before, but Gough, what does he do?
Well, it forces him to plan a narrow front offensive, and the position selected was Bullecourt, where the disadvantage of striking directly against the Hindon line was, he hoped, soon to be ameliorated by the possibility of a link-up with the advance of the Third Army.
Now, we've said about narrow fronts before. Everyone on either side can fire into it. A constricted front, they're getting the German troops on either flank are unengaged, and the Fifth Army assault at Bullecourt goes in at 04:45 on the 11th of April. And how would you describe it?
Complete disaster. Without any proper artillery barrage or support, they relied on tanks to provide paths through the masses of German barbed wire, and the mechanically unreliable tanks let them down.
Well, it was a disaster, you're right. And it's resented by the Australians to this day. I took a party of Australians to Bullecourt, and the tank corps had unwisely put a tank track as a memorial to the tank tour, which a couple of Australians spat on because they just felt it was an inappropriate place for it. The tank corps had tried their best. They can't help it if the tanks break down. But from the Australian perspective, it gave them a lasting distrust of tanks.
Well, the problem isn't the tanks, is it? The problem is the lack of artillery support. That's the problem.
That's at the heart of it. I think we'd say the British had essentially shot their bolt, hadn't they?
I don't know what that means.
Good. Small-scale attacks are going to continue. What are they trying to do with the small-scale attacks?
Well, they're trying to straighten the ground or seize key points like the Roux Chemical Works. Small-scale, they might have been, but each one brought another raft of casualties.
Yeah.
But the British, they're just not ready for another full-scale assault.
Yeah, they need fresh divisions. They need to get the artillery forward. They need to register the guns when they're in place. And whatever was going to happen, if that was going to happen, it's not going to happen quickly. To me, the battle's over at this point. And one of the reasons Arras, which is a successful start to a battle, has, I think, the highest daily rate of casualties, is that the battle doesn't stop on the 11th of April. So all through the 11th of April, the battle's raging on the ground. Where else is it raging on?
Well, it's also raging in the skies. And one ordinary young Royal Flying Corps officer wrote home to explain what it was that they were trying to achieve. And this is what Captain Bernard Rice of 8th Squadron has to say in his letter.
I'm going to let you into some of the work we do. In the first place, there is no reason to be alarmed at our casualties. We're not going under, but just emerging out on top again. We have been working in close contact with artillery and infantry. The infantry always feel they are being watched over. And indeed, a plane goes over first and bombs the points where they are held up, signals to headquarters where they've got to, and generally looks after their interests. Another plane watches for Hun gun flashes, and immediately on seeing any, signals down positions, etc., by wireless to our gunners, who proceed at once to silence them, being corrected onto the target, the meanwhile, by the plane. I've seen umpteen tanks go into action, crushing through all obstacles. Parties of Huns rushing towards our people with hands held high, and isolated battles in communication trenches. We have frequently swooped down and cleared a trench with our machine guns. All this, of course, has cost us some casualties, but it is worth the price, and most of them are wounds only. You start at dawn or a little before and finish about 8:30. I think he means at 9. We fly no matter the weather, excluding continuous snow and rain. And as we've seen, not always excluding now. Up to now, we have been having storms only, which we can fly around and dodge, and high gales. The latter very strong, so very often so strong and gusty that only the older hands can weather them and not turn seasick. This sort of work is going on all day long, and everybody is sticking it well. The Hun doesn't attempt such work. He goes about in bunches, and a few of his scouts try and catch us napping from time to time, while patrols of our own endeavour to catch him at it and keep us pretty well protected. Don't get anxious about me. I'm taking risks, of course. Everyone is. But I'm coming back all right, never fear. Now, I think there's two things this shows. What would you say the first thing it shows?
Well, it shows that Trenchard had got through the essence of his policy of continuous aerial offensive to his men.
Yeah.
And that they actually understood why they were risking their lives on a more than daily basis.
Well, the other thing is that he's writing home to his parents. So he's being optimistic. He's being optimistic both about what the situation really was, because as we've seen, the offensive beneath them is grinding to a halt. But in the end, and also he's underplaying the risks that he and his fellow pilots are going through. But what do you think about
his words? They do actually add the ring of sincerity about them, don't they? That allow us just to see how the core pilots endured with none of the promise of death or glory, that was offered up to the pick of the scout pilots. Now, the next day, on the 12th of April, there were once again heavy snowfalls, which severely hampered aerial activity. And at this point, we shall take a short break.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince, they exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
And welcome back. Now, we left the 12th of April, and we're going to pick up, unsurprisingly, on the 13th of April.
Oh, and at last, the weather's starting to improve a bit, isn't it? Yay! What does that mean if the weather improves?
Well, it means the air's soon alive with aircraft. Now, however, 59 Squadron, they suffered an utter disaster when a patrol of six RE-8s set out on a photographic reconnaissance of the Drocourt Queant switch line.
Switch line's one that sort of it goes sideways, if you like, and enables if a piece of ground's taken, that you can isolate it.
Now, only two of them had cameras. The other four were acting as close escorts.
Hang on, RE-8s acting as escorts to RE-8s.
Well, they should have had additional scout escort, as it was obvious that they'd be passing dangerously close to the Douai Lair of Jasta 11. Oh, dear.
Oh, and Fred's just farted.
Now, unfortunately, Fred's just farted, but also the escort failed to arrive. And Richtofen and five of his scouts did indeed make a most unwelcome appearance.
Oh, God. Well, in the combat that follows, it's a slaughter, really. It's not a combat. It's perfunctory. And all six RE-8s are shot down. This is a disaster for the, you know, for the squadron. But afterwards, those that survived and the victors and the vanquished, this is unbelievable, met in the Jasta 11 officers' mess. And you're going to be one of our favourites, Oberlautnant Manfred von Richtofen, of Jasta 11, the commander of Jasta 11.
One of the Englishmen, whom we had shot down and whom we had made prisoner, was talking to us. Of course, he inquired after the Red Aeroplane. It is not unknown, even among the troops in the trenches, and is called by them Le Diable Rouge. In the squadron to which he belonged, there was a rumour that the Red Machine was occupied by a girl, a kind of Joan of Arc. He was intensely surprised when I assured him that the supposed girl was standing in front of him. He did not intend to make a joke.
Oh, yes, he did.
Public school boy. Oh, that's hilarious.
Oh, I think that's a bit of banter from him. I can just imagine the scene. Flown by a girl.
I should imagine that was retold a number of times during the long, dreary years as a prisoner of war.
You've got to take your small victories when you're sat in a prisoner of war camp. Oh, dear. Well, the Royal Flying Corps, they're suffering heavy casualties during this. I mean, this is bloody April. Bloody April, it doesn't finish on the 9th of April. It's the 3 more weeks to go. What's the problem? Well, inexperienced pilots and observers, they're sent out as replacements for experienced ones, and they only last a matter of hours when they fall victim to experienced, practiced German aces, don't they? Give us an exit. What sort of statistics are we talking, Gary?
Well, some squadrons are losing almost their entire force in a single week, as illustrated by the 48th Squadron, who lost 10 crews. 10 crews between the 5th and 11th of April. Now, squadrons could lose 3, 4, 5, or even 6 aircraft in a single operation.
Well, so that would be a third of their effective strength in one operation.
Now, don't forget, this is on top of the daily trickle of casualties, which threaten to slowly erode them away to impotency.
You mean they lose one a day, basically, anyway? And if you think about it, that you can think what it must have been like. You could see your death coming towards you in a way, or death, wounding, or imprisonment, or disaster anyway.
Now, experience was at a premium and in the revolving doors environment of the officers' mess. As one pilot was lost, another would arrive within a few hours. Can you imagine that? That must be awful.
So a new pilot, a new observer in the core squadrons would arrive and to replace the ones who died that day. It must have been a weird atmosphere in the mess.
Terrible. Now, for 5 long days, the British had fought their diversionary battle on the Arras front. Yet, they had to keep the pressure up for 2 more days.
Why? Why, well, Gary?
What, that because Why? The date of the French assault was the 16th of April.
Right. Right.
Now, on the 14th of April, a scout patrol from 54th Squadron found themselves under heavy attack. And this is what 2nd Lieutenant Russell Smith of 54th Squadron says.
We came upon a hostile aircraft and drove them down. As my tracer bullets appeared to be hitting the target without causing any apparent damage, unfortunately, I stayed in the power dive too long. When I pulled out, I'd lost contact with my flight. I started to regain altitude, keeping a sharp lookout all around, especially above me, but there was no one close. I soon spotted 3 aircraft in a V formation below and behind, coming up from the east to attack. I carried on, watching them and looking for any others. When those below me got closer, I was convinced by their speed and peculiar markings that they belonged to Richthofen's travelling circus, otherwise known as flying circus. When I estimated that my machine would have come into their gun sights as they climbed and before they started to fire, I turned quickly and dived on the leader on a collision course, firing continuously. The 2 outside planes fanned outwards in climbing turns, and the leader soon pushed his nose down and passed under me. I started evasive action, and then my engine misfired, and I knew I had run out of fuel. Gulp. Without the engine, there was only one defence. I closed the throttle and put the machine into a tight vertical spin. You'd have called that a split-arse spin, I think.
I would have done, yeah.
Intending to come out of it at a low altitude and land. There was no indication that my attackers were following me down, and I didn't see them again. It may be that they thought they'd finished me.
Well, that's interesting because in those circumstances, it's almost impossible to tell whether an aircraft was fatally damaged or merely feigning injury to get away from the pursuing hunters. As height was all important in aerial fighting, it was often considered pointless to descend alongside a doomed aircraft just for the satisfaction of seeing it splinter into smithereens on crashing.
Yeah, because if you surrendered at height to see what was happening, you might be bounced yourself and you might end up being dead next to the other one, yeah.
Now, this was, of course, that's exactly what Russell Smith was trying to achieve. He was relying on that. And this is what he goes on to say.
When in a small plane, spinning in a tight corkscrew motion, one seems to be in the centre of a huge bowl of which the horizon is the brim and the whole earth, as far as one can see, forms the bowl, which is turning about a point directly below at the same speed and in the opposite direction from that in which the plane is spinning. I'd be sick. When nearer the ground, I abandoned the spin and glided west, taking evasive action against possible ground fire. When the throttle was open, the engine started, but only for a moment. The tank was empty. I could see trenches, but not occupants, and I thought I was near the front lines, but couldn't determine on which side, or if I was in no man's land. I was surprised that there was not more shell holes. Right in front of me, the ground appeared level, so I touched down as slowly as possible in a tail-down stall landing and was out of the pancake, the cockpit, out of the pancake. I was thinking that's a pancake, like yeah. The other bloke was trying to do. And that made me say pancake. And was out of the cockpit before the plane had stopped running. The aircraft was intact. It just lacked fuel.
Now, it didn't pay to linger too long above the pockmarked surface of no man's land, so he had to go to ground as quickly as possible. And Second Lieutenant Russell Smith goes on to say,
without a moment's delay, I started to run or scramble as quickly as possible in full flying kit to the nearest shell hole. I was about to jump in when I saw that it was half full of water. Continuing to another hole further from the plane, I found it dry and clean and still warm from the explosion of the shell that had created it. Artillery was ranging on my machine and the ground around me shook continually from the near misses. When the bombardment slackened, there was a noise of a rifle bullet passing over my head. After one or two more bullets, I suspected a sniper was busy. How does it end? Well, you have to read my book. What's the book called? Bet you can't remember.
Tumult in the skies.
Bloody April.
Now, wounded by shrapnel, Russell Smith eventually escaped after his series of terrible experiences.
Which you'll have to read about.
In Bloody April.
Yeah.
Now, it's important to remember that not all missions ended in failure.
Yeah.
The basis of the Royal Flying Corps' success was that their sheer numbers allowed them to bear the losses, to keep on going, and most importantly of all, to keep getting the results the Army wanted, and in fact needed.
Yeah, needed, desperately needed. And we're going to look at a couple of successful missions, because otherwise you get the wrong impression. And this one is a successful photographic reconnaissance on the morning of 14th of April, and it's carried out by a 25 squadron who were, they were lucky enough to be being escorted by the Sopwith triplanes of No. 8 Naval Squadron, Royal Naval Air Service. Good to play tribute to those lads as well, because they're playing their part. And you're going to be one of those escorts, Flight Sub-Lieutenant Edward Crundall of 8 Naval Squadron.
At 8 a.m, Booker led Sea Flight on a patrol to escort the FEs of 25 Squadron RFC, who are on photographic duty. My engine was running badly, and I could not keep up with the formation. At about 9 a.m, when a long way on the German side of the lines, I saw two machines flying parallel to the west. I'd never seen a type of aeroplane quite like them. They looked somewhat like Newports, but much bigger. I realised they were probably Huns, which Sea Flight had not seen. I was a bit scared because I was a straggler all on my own, and these ominous-looking aeroplanes blocked my way to safety. I was at a great disadvantage because my engine was running so badly. I realised I must make a decision. The thought of being taken prisoner terrified me, so I decided to go and have a look and sell my life as dearly as possible, if I had to fight. I climbed as steeply as I could, and they immediately did likewise, so I became more suspicious than ever. They were about 2 or 3 miles away, so when slightly above them, I turned abruptly to the left and approached. At about 100 yards distance, I saw they were both two-seaters, and almost immediately afterwards the Iron Cross on the top plane of one of them, so I knew for certain they were Huns. At that distance, one of the observers on the back seat opened fire on me. This made me furious. I literally saw red and dived on the tail of the nearest firing my gun all the time. I got closer and closer to his tail until I was almost touching it and could see the pilot and observer's heads and every detail of the machine. Suddenly, the German machine fell over on one wing and went down in a steep nosedive. I was thrilled and started to relax, but only for a moment because I was attacked from behind by the other enemy machine. Again, I saw red and was just as furious as on the first occasion. I swung round, got on his tail, and opened fire at the same close range. After a long spell of firing, he started to dive, and it got steeper and steeper until I realised the triplane's wings would break off if I increased my own dive. Previously, I had thrown caution to the winds because, as I entered each fight, I did not expect to come out of them alive. So I shut off the engine and eased the triplane out of the dive when I found it was very left-wing heavy and I had to fly with the stick fully over to the right. When I returned to sea flight, I was told my triplane was almost falling to pieces and quite unsafe to fly in its present condition. The flying wires were stretched and very slack, and one of the centre section struts had cracked and bent out of shape. Only one bullet hole had been found, which was in the lowest left-hand plane.
Now, he's quite lucky that he means when he returned to sea flight, it doesn't mean the formation, it means back home at his airfield. That's a narrow escape, and it isn't bullets. It's that he's thrown his aircraft around and he's overdone it, and it nearly fell apart in the air. Does he get awarded those two kills, which may not have been shot down?
His tail, as it were, is backed up by the corroborative reports from kite balloon observers and one of the pilots from 25 Squadron.
Fair enough.
So he was awarded the two victories. Perhaps more to the point, the FE-2Bs had managed to complete their mission undisturbed and taken a full set of photographs.
So as an escort, they'd done their job because the machines, that the FE-2Bs they were escorting, had got the photos. And that's what the army want and need, as you point out. It's not just want, they need them.
Now, you might get the impression from the British reports that the sky was literally teeming with German scouts. But in fact, there were usually well under 50 of them in action on any given day along the whole of the Arras front.
So what's going on there? Well, outnumbered, they certainly were, the German scouts. So how do they husband them? How do they use them? What's their policy like? What are they doing?
Well, they only come together for a specific purpose. As you rightly say, outnumbered, they were fighting a defensive battle, and they would only engage in combat when they considered it was to their advantage. Precious trained scout pilots couldn't be thrown away in useless gestures against the odds.
So they'd only fight if they were in the superiority of numbers, generally, or it was a desperate, something desperate was going on. And yes, I could see the point. If you're a highly trained scout pilot and I shoot down you, that's no good. I need to shoot down 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 50 before it's worthwhile giving your own life. So there's an element of caution. Wow.
Now, many of the British pilots, they take heart from the recent advance on the ground. They can see the advances the army had achieved, and although the new German lines and belts of barbed wire were equally obvious, they felt that at last there were real grounds for hope. And once more, you're going to tell us what Captain Bernard Rice of 8 Squadron says.
He's pretty optimistic, chap, this, and he says this. You know, I think next autumn we'll see the final coup, if not actually the end of the war. We are still advancing. There has been a pause while we cleared a line of heights. I think we got them this morning, in which case we shall make another rush forward.
But he's not wrong, though, is he?
Oh, no, I think he is wrong. The situation, if anything, it's fast deteriorating.
In his prediction.
Oh.
Next autumn.
Next autumn. Oh, ooh!
He's not wrong.
I said, Gary, I never noticed that. But next autumn, I was thinking this autumn.
No, next autumn.
Yeah,
it's a northern-southern thing, this Friday, next Friday, that sort of thing.
Yeah, I'd never seen it that way. That's absolutely fascinating. And he isn't wrong.
Now, the situation on the ground, if anything, as you say...
At that moment, what a great point. Well done.
It's fast deteriorating. None of the recent British small-scale attacks had succeeded in achieving their objectives. And
they're doomed. Yeah. They're not going to succeed. There's no chance.
Well, they're made on narrow fronts designed to see specific tactical objectives, and they fell hapless prey to the concentrated fire of the German artillery and machine guns from both flanks, who were not under attack and could pour in a murderous fire.
Well, it's just murderous, isn't it? Yeah. The Royal Flying Corps, they're trying their best, but infantry casualties are rising fast. 15th of April, the weather's, for the most part, unsuitable for flying. It's very blustery, high winds and terrible visibility, so there's not a lot of point in them being up there. But still, some aircraft managed to get up and get aloft. And you're going to tell us a story of the RE-8, that's the new artillery observation and core aircraft, flown by 2nd Lieutenant W. Buckingham and W.R. Cox of 15 Squadron. And they achieved something quite special. They're Australian, and 2nd Lieutenant Wilfred Cox of 15 Squadron Royal Flying Corps left this account. It's a fantastic achievement what they get up to.
We heard heavy rifle fire about 4,000 yards behind the front line and saw considerable numbers of our troops in extended order, obviously in action. Further inspection revealed that the enemy had launched an attack against the Australians, who were on our right and facing Queant, and that they had been driven back to the point where we heard the rifle fire. We heard afterwards that the initial surprise of the German attack was so complete that they were able to destroy a battery of 4.5-inch howitzers by hand. One brigadier is said to have fought in his pyjamas. By the time we had appreciated the situation, it was about 0600 hours. No other aircraft was up at the time because of the weather. Under these circumstances, it was something of a field day for us. Confident that the weather was keeping aircraft away, the Germans seemed to make no attempt at concealment. We commenced sending zone calls and Sue obtained replies from the artillery. By 08:30, the enemy had been forced back as far as our front line, where he broke and fled back across no man's land for the gap which had been cut in their wire during the night. We saw great congestion at these points. It was like a crowd struggling to rush through a narrow door. Our machine guns and field guns were firing into the mass and caused many casualties. Over 200 prisoners had been captured by our troops.
Now, you were being 2nd Lieutenant Wilfred Cox. I made a mistake. He wasn't Australian, but the other chap, Buckingham, was Australian.
That's why I didn't do an Australian accent.
Yes, you really are proving to be correct in all fronts in this particular podcast. He's helping his own countrymen because it's the Australians that are under attack in their hour of need, Gary, their hour of need. But what do you think about this? Why am I so entranced by this particular incident, do you think?
Well, because that kind of exploit was the absolute essence of the work of the Royal Flying Corps. The veritable deluge of shells brought down by the zone calls had probably killed more Germans than were killed by any of the Great War aces over the whole of their flying career.
Yeah, a zone call is basically you just, every one of the core artillery, which is a lot of batteries, will open up, not at a target, but at a square on the map. And that, there's a German division attacking across no man's land in that square. It's a lethal method of opening fire. And it is just death.
Now, for all the suffering, all the triumphs, both in the air and on the ground, it's surely soon going to be over, isn't it? The Great War 1914-1917 would be finished once and for all by Nivelle's great advance, which was time to commence when, Pete?
16th of April 1917, and he promised victory within 48 hours, hence 1914-17, the Great War. Victory would be soon.
Hurrah.
Or would it?
Cheers, Pete.
Cheers.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Thanks for listening. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook to learn more about each episode. And if you'd like to support the podcast, you have a couple of options. You can buy us a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/PGMH or consider subscribing to the podcast for only £2 per month and get ad-free listening and bonus content. You can find links for both on our Facebook and Twitter accounts.
Sounds great, doesn't it?